The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is Indian Education for All?
Indian Education for All is actually a constitutional mandate that requires every public school system in Montana to provide Indian education in whatever curriculum that they can, on and off the reservation, Indian and non-Indian. It's in the Constitution. There's no other constitution in the United States that has that mandate to teach Native American studies and issues and culture to their students, K through 12. Even though it's a mandate, most teachers see it as an opportunity, and it works better that way, as an opportunity rather than the actual mandate that it is.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with historian, teacher, and poet Joseph McGeeshick about Montana's Native American poets and what's happening on the Fort Peck Indian Reservation. We'll also hear a few of his poems.
We just came out with a new poetry collection, Indian Ed for All. It's called Born into Poetry. It was a project that was done through OPI, the Indian Education Department there. Julie Saylor spearheaded the project, and what they did was they collected a number of poems from Native American poets, Montana poets. There was Minerva Allen, who's an Assiniboine, Mandy Smoker, Mandy Broaddus, who's also a Assiniboine poet, Henry Realbird, who was once the poet laureate of Montana, a Crow poet, Dick Littlebird, who's a Cheyenne poet and also president of Dullknife Community College. Lois Welch actually read James Welch's stuff that they included, which was nice. We had a get-together at the Myrna Loy Center in Helena, where they brought all the poets together, and we all read. But we read the poems that were in the K through 12 collection. The whole purpose of it was to basically introduce K through 12 teachers and students to Native American poetry in Montana, and to demonstrate that there is a, you know, fairly sizable, recognizable community of Native American poets that exist in Montana, that live in Montana. In fact, a lot of them still live in Indian country, like myself, and that's their subject matter, is they write about their people and their place, and that's what makes them interesting in some corners. That also makes them perfect for this Indian Ed for All literature programs, perfect for Indian poets to be exposed to schools and to children who want to learn more about poetry.
It sounds like that collection is also a chance for poets from all of the tribes to be represented in one place.
Definitely. It's kind of a pan-Indian collection, and if you say that, but like pan-Indianism is by nature, it's a positive, can be a positive, and also can be a negative thing. In this sense, it's quite positive in allowing Indian and non-Indian students the opportunity to experience Native American poetry written by Native Americans.
Are some of the poems in the native languages?
Some are, yes. Not very many, but the ones that have a strong language connection, like the Crow, the Salish, some of those poems are in their languages. Not a lot, though.
I think the legislature approved money for language classes for the tribes. Is that something that's happening on the Fort Peck Reservation also?
Actually, Fort Peck Reservation has been working on languages through the local schools, K through 12, and through the community college for a long time, even before this legislation came about. But this will help speed things up quite a lot. Because if, you know, we were so zealous as eradicating the language, you know, 100 and some years ago, if we were that zealous in bringing it back, then we would, you know, our languages would have a chance.
For people who are not from northeastern Montana, who might not know where Fort Peck is, just describe a little bit about the region.
Fort Peck's in the northeast corner of Montana along Highway 2, along the Missouri River. In fact, the Missouri River is the southern boundary of the Fort Peck Reservation. It's about 2.2 million acres. It's about 80 miles by 40 miles, kind of a rectangle, roughly. And it's farmland and grazing land and bench country land from the Missouri River. It's traditionally Assiniboine country, but after the 1862 warfare in Minnesota and the 1876 to the 1882 warfare with the Sioux in the little, kind of the little, ended in the Little Bighorn, Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse and those groups and Gaul, those Sioux Indians. The Lakotas, as they call themselves, after those two main, that main groups of warfare in those two groups of Sioux, the Dakotas and Lakotas, they were forced to into this area, which was traditionally Assiniboine country. And the Assiniboines took them in and welcomed them, even though, because linguistically, Assiniboine and Sioux, the Dakotas and Lakotas, are very much related. And they are culturally, being Northern Plains buffalo hunting cultures. So it was easy for them to see that they were in trouble and on the run and needed help. And they came to settle in this area. And after 1886 to 88, it was a two-year period, which culminated in the Sweetgrass Hills Treaty, which formed the Fort Peck Reservation and also the Fort Belknap Reservation and the Blackfeet Reservation.
You have an advanced degree in history.
Yeah, master's in history. Yeah.
And so what would you tell people who aren't familiar with Fort Peck, the area, and the tribes, beyond what you just said? What would you tell them to maybe correct some misperceptions?
Well, first of all, we're not a gaming tribe, even though gaming, to a certain extent, limited gaming we have on the reservation. The stereotype is, no, we're not a gambling tribe. We don't have a lot of gambling money. The area has been traditionally agriculture. Indians, since the inception of the reservation, the creation of the reservation, have been involved in agriculture, either farming and ranching, on a very limited basis, mainly because of restrictions on trust land, and also because of a generation after generation of almost forced dependency. And that eventually, after four or five generations of dependency, turns into entitlement. And so we have a lot of subsidized living here, subsidized education, subsidized food programs, subsidized housing. You can see a lot of the, since the inception of the reservation in 1888, from now, it's been one long subsidy, one after the next, and not allowing the Indians to be prosperous and to have growth and opportunity, you know, built on who they are truly, and not on a foreign system that was imposed upon them.
Because the way of providing for the people was taken away.
Yes, the buffalo are gone, you know, 60 to 90 million buffalo at one time, a renewable resource that provided just about every aspect of life. And once that is gone, in a matter of less than a generation, in some instances, you have to replace it with something. And it's replaced with government dependency. That's when you get the flour and the sugar and the coffee and the salt and the foreign foods to these people in a mere generation. And so you learn how to make fry bread, and which is kind of like corn pone in the South. I mean, it fills you up, but it's empty calories. And so you go from a life basically that once was dried food and very healthy, whether it be dried meat or dried berries or roots, you know, that you had gathered and you know, you had a hand in harvesting and preserving, to an existence that is a handout and kind of a welfare system, basically an early welfare system, and you have this food that's not healthy for you. I mean, of course, your whole life is changed around, not only from the food that you eat, but the clothes that you wear, the language that you speak, and even the religion that you worship. All of those things have been replaced, forced upon these groups of people. So you can imagine that, if you have an identity, if you're looking for an identity, a lot of times it's pretty difficult to corral one and to be very proud of that at certain times. Of course, you could have the whole romantic idea of the Plains Indian on horseback and hunting buffalo and the free spirit, but that was a very, very short time in Plains history. It only lasted probably at the most maybe 80 years if you want to look at it in terms of, times in history.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, all of that had a huge effect on the self-esteem of the people.
Yeah. Oh, definitely, yes. If you don't have any part in your life, from the aspect from your food to your religion and to your basic identity, then you have really a very sad existence. And that, coupled with the poverty, and even in the early period of the reservation, the first generation, downright starvation, where dozens of people were dying each winter because they didn't have enough food. And in fact, the early 1880s, because the rations didn't come in, 300 Assiniboines starved to death just west of here, Wolf Point. In fact, my mother's people, 300 of them, one winter, 300 people died because they didn't have enough food to eat. And that wasn't just one incident. Of course, that's the most tragic incident. After that, year after year after year, you can read the Indian agent reports. 12 Assiniboine died last year. 37 Sioux died last year. And it goes on and on and on, well into the first decade of the 20th century.
You're also a poet, in addition to being a historian. And all of the tragedies that you're describing, I mean, they're cumulative. This is something that has built generation after generation, and it's just a pervasive feeling. How does your poetry help mitigate some of that?
Well, I think it's more contemporary than historic, even though there are historic elements in there. I just can't help but try and juxtapose what's going on today and how some connection to the past, either the beginning of the reservation days or some time in history before or immediately after that time, and how it relates today with some of the problems that we have on the reservation as far as poverty, unemployment, domestic abuse, drugs and alcohol, people that are uneducated. And I don't mean educated in the sense of the Western education that you need a master's degree or that you need a bachelor's degree or even a high school diploma or a GED, but educated in the sense of your community and what your commitment is to your family and the community, which will, if you take care of them, they'll take care of you. We seem to have lost a lot of that in the past five generations.
And finding a place in the community.
Exactly. Yeah. Where is your place? And I think that's why a lot of young people turn to alternative lifestyles that aren't as positive as they could be. Of course, gangs. We have gangs here on the reservation as well as they have gangs, other places. Of course, they're not the Crips and the Bloods, but they act like them sometimes.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with historian and poet Joseph Magishik. We'll be right back after a short break to hear some of his poetry. Don't go away. I know you've been writing some new poetry. Is there a poem that you can read that talks about some of these issues in the modern context?
Yeah, I got one that, a real blunt poem, if you want to hear that one. It's, I don't know if you could do it on the radio.
I might have to put in a few beeps, but I can do that. I mean, as long as there aren't more bleeps than words in the poem.
No, there's just a couple of bleeps. The other stuff is a little raw, but we'll look at it here. I actually wrote it about a friend of mine because he told me about his life, and actually his girlfriend, he was telling me about his problems, and I wasn't writing it down at the time. I was just thinking about it, and about a month later, I just started writing, and it kind of came out just in a matter of probably about a half hour, and then I let it go for a little while and did a couple more edits and a couple more edits, and then I said, okay, it's fine. So it's a very short poem. It's titled, "That Is All I Can Call My Own." Corner bag geeked out little bitch, spending our last $7 on an inflated bottle of Captain Morgan. Too damn lazy to fill the ice trays with water that nobody cares to drink, and sometimes showers are questionable. Her boyfriend begs me not to screw his woman in this little Beirut east of Devil's Alley, where illegal substances overshadow intentions. Walking west away from a stranger I've known for 7 years, and I still don't know that son of a bitch's name. Fall back on Ebonics, you big Indian, 'cause that's the only language you now know. Go ahead and keep up those postmodern traditions, selling yourself and children and whatever else they want for whiskey, oxys, bindles of go-go, and even bad coffee, not to mention your EBT card, looking forward and fantasizing about the first of the month and income tax time, living for the kids' per capita checks. Your yeast infection started with me, not the others you flippantly f***ed. Now, between us, that is all I can call my own.
That's an example of one of your friends going through kind of a really traumatic personal crisis in a relationship. Is that the norm?
No, that's not. That's the exception. Most people aren't like that here. Most people in Fort Peck work hard. They have jobs. In fact, unsurprisingly, I bet if you canvass most people, they pay income tax, federal income tax, like all Indians do that work and get taxes taken out of their checks. They're exempt from state tax, yes, because that's a legal exemption that both the state and the Indian government have worked out over years. And that's always been there, and it's a legal exemption that anybody would take. So yes, most people are these people who work and pay their taxes, and if they have a legal exemption, of course they'll take it. And get up every morning and go to work and try to teach their children, you know, the best things they can. The reason why I think the problems are so visible is because it's like an alcoholic being in the closet. You have to have a closet to be, you know, to hide it. We don't have a closet here. Our closets don't exist because of the economics of it. You know, it's out there in the open. You see people on the streets. Are there people who stay in their houses and kind of hide around and do bad things? I'm sure there are, but again, that's not the norm. Those are the exceptions. And most people are hardworking. In fact, a lot of them are Christians. They go to church. My mother, who passed away, you know, was a devout Catholic, went to church every single Sunday, went to rosary on Wednesdays, and prayed hard for everybody.
I think a lot of times the exception gets publicized.
Definitely. Yeah.
Because that's what the media picks up on.
Exactly. It's not that everything's negative. I can read you a positive poem right now that could be just the total opposite. And it's about this area, the Fort Peck Indian Reservation. I don't think it has anything to do with Indians, though. So it's quite the opposite. More than place than people, I guess you would say. The title's "The Sun's Setting Rays Must Have Done Something Spectacular." The sun's setting rays must have done something spectacular, dipping west to where the high line faded away, far off in the direction of the Little Rockies and the Bear's Paw, lightly touching a farmer's tanned face along the silty Milk River, letting him know the thoughts of his lonely wife's supper of meat and potatoes and thick slices of freshly baked white bread. Coming out of the distant gray clouds, out of the second best light of the day, showing warmly on the south sandy, high-cut bank of the upper Missouri, giving a silver glisten to the large green waxy leaves of old-leaning cottonwoods, sharp rays running almost straight down to those western Montanans in the distance, like they've always done, past those small great northern railroad towns of Glasgow and Malta, then Havre, Shelby, and ending just west of Cutbank. Gazing westerly for that razor-thin, leftover and used light, reflecting in orange, yellow, soft red, and sometimes sweet lavender, leaving us few lucky eastern Montanans amazed and wondering, much like those old prairie threshing machines throwing up steam and chaff. Eventually, the end of the day finally quiets them, settling the land in dark and creating a hopeful yearning for a promised tomorrow. The sun-setting rays must have done something spectacular for the woman to have whispered about it silently that night in her lover's ear. So yeah, there's good and bad just like everywhere. You just got to find it, I guess.
What I would like you to do, if you don't mind, would be to pick out another poem, say what it's about, and then read it for us.
This poem is about a very special friend of mine who lives in New York. She was in the film industry as a set designer, and actually now she does real short films now, just kind of art films in the sense they try and tell a real short story. Not a lot of words in her films. Her name is Bianca Butti, B-U-T-T-I. The name of this, I wrote this because there's a lot of poems written about body parts, you know, their eyes, you know, hands,
right,
and lips and ears. And there were. I couldn't find a poem about nipples, I guess. So I started to write this poem, and it's about Bianca's nipples. This is the title, Bianca's Nipples. More sacred than any Uwipi ceremony, worshipped along the Ganges and all the holiest of rivers, especially the upper Missouri and all its silt. Their heat generates more passion than the 40 or 80 rocks those Hayokas use to drive some sorry ass out of their lodges. They must be just like the Himalayas, thrust up between two continents, like the Swiss Alps, the world's creation of human tectonic plates, in stanzas so simple. And then, of course, they knew that the journey from Helena to Pony took more than third gear all the way, all those dried up cottonwood branches arriving at night with Hollow Top looming high above to the west, past old gold mines, washing your feet back in eastern Montana while you decided to go a westerly toward places like Portland and down the coast to Hollywood, turning east toward old beginnings now overcrowded with man's most diverse edifices of steel that once dangled red Iroquois Indians and the last of those Mohicans, different than the distance and the dark of the big open and the paths to the high benchlands. Small nipples served as my compass that spins needles to the direction of plains, of mountains and hot springs with fireflies, like us, confused from late summer meteor showers, pointing to the trend that finally gets to us here in this remote country south of the Medicine Line, opposite the direction from whence you arrived, out in front of you, announcing your coming, far past bodies going through motions of thought and song, unruffled and newly made, and stiff animal hides with changed feeling that hit them over and over again. These are shortened days because people are no longer tough, nowhere near like the weather and the land it shapes, and in all directions coming with headwinds that seem always there no matter the direction we are roaming, Bianca's nipples seeking them out like two buffalo in a snowstorm.
All right, let's wrap up with one final question. When you think about the state of education on the Fort Peck Reservation right now and the state of the people, what are you encouraged by?
I'm encouraged by there are more Indian teachers in our classes now on the reservation. We have four schools here, and there are Indian teachers in all of them. I know those teachers that are teaching there. In fact, I taught them in some of my community college classes. They're there. They're from here. They know the children that are there. Some of their children are going to school. And that is really going to help the future generations, not only the Indian kids themselves, but even the non-Indians in being exposed to the diversity that it has to offer around here, that's been here for a long, long time. And it's kind of finally coming, kind of rising to the top, like the cream does, the best part.
So the Indian children up until this time had always been taught by non-Indians.
Pretty much, yes. And there are non-Indian teachers here who are really good teachers that have been around here for a long time. Most of my teachers were non-Indian teachers, and I loved most of them. Of course, there were a few that I didn't get along with, but, you know, that's part of life. That's the test.
Is technology helping?
Technology is probably one of the most helpful things and is going to prove to be most of the helpful mechanisms that will allow Indian children to succeed, because they can take that home with them. They don't have to go home, and sometimes there are problems there. And in the past, when I was in school, I take my school books home, and that was it. Now I can take the whole classroom, the whole world classroom home, and it makes much more of a difference.
Nice. Anything else you want people to know about Fort Peck?
Come and visit us. You know, if you want to know about us, you know, come to the source. Come and see us. And we have, you know, all, I guess, the things that people like to see, powwows. And we even have rodeos, Indian rodeos and Indian cowboys. We have a great community college here. Our industry is starting to pick up a little bit with the oil, not a lot, but there is there. We always have the traditional economies of agriculture. And we still will have that. The buffalo are back here on the reservation. And even though that's a little bit of a controversy, it's still something that I think will help people grow and become aware that, you know, just one thing is not the best. You know, this mono agriculture or depending on one thing is something that we have to get around and look at multiple avenues that will make people, you know, have growth and prosperity and happiness.
Joseph Magishik lives in Wolf Point, Montana, and teaches at Fort Peck Community College. Look for more information about him and the books he's written, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.